This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good afternoon and welcome to the show. It's Meera Sivasuthi. Autism has become synonymous with despair. The word conjures up nightmarish visions of a rocking child locked in her own impenetrable world, unable to speak, smile and laugh with those who love her. While that is true for a very small proportion of children at the extreme end of the autism spectrum, many more individuals on the spectrum go on to lead fulfilling, even brilliant lives. In the studio with me today, Dr. Peter Mitchell. He's the editor of the British Journal of Psychology. He's also a professor and director of studies in psychology of the University of Nottingham Malaysia campus. We're discussing heightened abilities and special interests in people with autism. Welcome to the show, Dr. Peter. How are you today?
I'm very well, and I'm delighted to be here, Meera. Actually, do you know, I was doing a class today with my students, and I said to them, what's your favourite radio show? And they said, Hits FM. And I said, oh, OK, well, can you guess what my favourite is? And without hesitation, they all said, BFM.
You had it written across your forehead.
I think it's because of the sticker on my car, actually. Bribe-free Malaysian.
Actually, you were the first person who walked through our doors from the University of Nottingham to do a show with us.
Is that right?
Some years ago.
I think it's back in 2009.
Yes, you did. Yeah. And I remember you coming on to say that, you know, you love the station. You wanted to be a part of it. So you have done some research on heightened abilities. I mean, we always talk about Rain Man or even, you know, quirky TV series like The Bridge from the US with, you know, autistic heroes with genius-level abilities. But how accurate are these depictions?
I don't know about the TV shows. I haven't watched them, but I have watched Rain Man. Mm-hmm. And I think it's a very, very accurate depiction. And moreover, the people who made it in Hollywood were very, very sensible in coming over to the UK to meet a friend and colleague of mine, Professor Linda Pring from Goldsmiths College, who's a real expert, a real world expert on special abilities in autism. And they took a huge amount of advice from her. And I believe she met Dustin Hoffman as well, and she gave him lots of advice. Mm-hmm. And they managed to do a brilliant portrayal. So I think it's very accurate. But, of course, the condition that they're depicting in that movie is a rare condition.
Why so? Why, what's so rare about it? Because we know autism, you know, is a spectrum. Mm. It's on a spectrum, right?
Yeah.
It depends on where exactly you're on the spectrum. So is it all doom and gloom? I was reading a lot of articles in that we need to celebrate people on the spectrum more than anything else. It is not all doom and gloom.
Yeah.
But the research that you have done, what are you working on?
Yeah. Well, the reason why I say it's a rare condition is a few decades ago, people used to think that autism was extremely rare. They used to think it was, you know, 1 in 10,000. But more recently, people have come to recognize it's probably more at the rate of 1 per 100 of the population or even higher. But within that population that have autism or another developmental disorder, those that show a special ability, like we see in Rain Man, he's a numerical calculator in the movie, people like that are probably more like 10% of the people of the population that have a disorder.
The 1 in 100.
So, of the 1 in 100, 10% of those maybe would show kind of some kind of special ability. Yeah, so it's quite rare.
Okay.
And sorry, you're asking about my research.
Your research, yeah. So, why heightened abilities? And if it's only 10%, then why do we need to know this?
Well, I think the reason why we need to know is because not only does it give us insight into autism, but it gives us insight into the way the normally working human brain functions as well. And this is why it's of special interest. The 10% that show a special ability, in many cases, this special ability would be heightened perception. And for some individuals, heightened perception is something they can use to their advantage when drawing. And there are some celebrated cases, like the famous case of a boy called Stephen Wiltshire, who's able to do marvellous architectural drawings. In fact, he's been doing drawings of entire cities, just from a quick look, you know, helicopter ride for 20 minutes over the city, and then later from memory he can draw these images in fabulous detail. And I think in the case of someone like Stephen Wiltshire, he has a marvellous talent for seeing the world and for remembering the detail. And additionally, I would suggest he's developed an ability in being able to depict that on paper. But I think the most interesting part of his ability is his ability to see the world accurately. Now, you might say, well, someone like Stephen Wiltshire, who can draw in that way, is exceptionally rare. But the research I've been conducting at Nottingham University suggests that it's quite common, in fact, maybe even normal in people with autism, to see the world accurately.
Mm-hmm. What do you mean by accurately?
Right.
Are you saying then I'm not seeing the world accurately?
I am saying exactly that.
Okay. Please tell me how I need to be a little bit more, you know.
It's not a bad thing to be inaccurate.
Hmm.
There are many famous cases of famous examples of visual illusions that trick the eye. And the fact that we fall for these illusions gives us clues about the way the visual system's working.
Mm-hmm.
And in particular, we are compelled to see the world three-dimensionally. And some of the visual illusions that are most powerful are illusions that have false 3D cues in them. And so they trick us into having a misperception, if you like.
Mm-hmm.
And we can measure the level, we can measure the degree or the strength of the illusion, we can measure the perception. I can give you an example, actually. I brought my laptop along so I can show you later.
Okay.
But using a special tool to measure illusion strength, we can measure that same illusion strength in people with autism. And what we find is that they fall for the illusion less than typically developing people. And I'm talking about ordinary people with autism, not talking about people with a special ability.
Mm-hmm.
And it is exceptionally rare to find somebody with a clinical disorder, an official clinical disorder diagnosed by a professional, to perform not worse on some kind of test, but to perform better than ordinary people.
Mm-hmm.
It's very, very rare to find that. But in the case of autism, we do see that. And I suspect that some people, like Stephen Wiltshire, are able to use this to their advantage and develop heightened ability and perhaps do very well in the world as a consequence of that.
Okay. So it really depends on the field you're in, because autism is much more common among engineers than in the general population.
Yeah, yeah.
Is that where it stems from? Engineering is different.
Are you asking, does engineering cause autism?
No. They seem to be inclined towards engineering.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it's true that, we can present a test or a measure of autistic characteristics. And, I mean, it's another thing to diagnose somebody officially as having autism. But nevertheless, you can present a test that shows that somebody is heading in that direction.
Mm-hmm.
And there are various reports that people who are in engineering professions might be a little bit vulnerable. And insofar as that's the case, one might ask, is that because doing engineering makes you autistic? Or is it that if you have that tendency anyway, if you have that kind of mind, that you might find yourself more comfortable doing an engineering kind of subject? And the latter seems to be the case, namely that somebody who is more inclined to seeing the world
accurately
it's not surprising that they're inclined to go into engineering. Now, whether this is true in Malaysia, I don't know the answer to that. And the reason why I raise this point in particular is because if we take a look at the UK, the people that choose to do engineering, it's the great majority of people are doing it would be boys, and there aren't many girls doing engineering in the UK.
And autism is more prevalent amongst boys.
Yeah. And I'll come to that in a moment.
Mm-hmm.
It's not just that. It's that engineering is not as popular a subject at university level as a subject like psychology,
mm-hmm.
actually. And psychology is possibly the most popular university subject now in the UK. And in a country like Malaysia, it seems to me that engineering is a very popular subject, and moreover that there are a large number of girls doing engineering, and it might well be the case that it's because the families of those kids think it's a good career, and, mm-hmm. and rightly so, of course it is a good career.
Yeah.
Whereas in the UK, I think kids have more scope, more freedom from the parents, perhaps, to choose their own subject. And when they're given that choice, they choose a subject like psychology instead of engineering.
Yep.
So I wouldn't be surprised if, because engineering is seen as more popular, it's more popular with girls in particular, and the families encourage the kids to do that, I'm not sure we would see this predominance of people, well, it's not predominance, but a fairly common instance of people with autism in the engineering subjects in Malaysia.
Right.
But we do in the UK, and I think we do in other places like the USA.
Which area of the brain are you really studying, Peter? Because... which part of the brain is actually controlling this so-called illusion that you're talking about?
it's a very good question. And in terms of how you see the world, in terms of perception, we're talking about the rear part of the brain, the occipital lobe, mm-hmm. and with influence from the parietal lobe. But famously, people think that the seat of autism is more likely to be found in the frontal areas of the brain. And this brings me to the next point I wanted to make, actually, because what you might see in people with autism is quite often a talent for being able to see the world accurately.
Mm-hmm.
But the other side of the coin is that they perhaps not so well at understanding the social aspect of things. And some people have speculated that the reason why the social brain isn't developing so well in people with autism is due to the frontal area of the brain not working optimally. Now, it's entirely possible that if the frontal part isn't working optimally, that perhaps somehow this gives an opportunity for the other parts of the brain, perhaps the occipital or perhaps the parietal, to develop more strongly in some ways.
To compensate in a way.
Well, yeah, and you know, if you talk about compensation, it raises the whole issue about development in people with autism, what happens in development. Because it's been quite common in the past for people to talk about autism as if it's something that's static, something that you have and it's not changing. But autism is, of course, a developmental disorder, and it's a disorder, therefore, that has an impact upon how you develop. And what we see in people who are developing typically is a tremendous attention and focus on the social world and an exercise of the imagination as well in a way that relates to the social world. And linked with this, of course, an essential feature of the social world is the development of language.
Mm-hmm.
And in some sense, when you step back and think about it, it's bordering on miraculous that a child aged between 12 and 18 months, a typically developing child, 12 to 18 months, without any formal tuition, without any prior knowledge, is able to acquire language and can speak. It's absolutely incredible.
Mm-hmm.
So children apparently have this natural ability to learn, to acquire language, which is tied up with engaging in the social world, because you don't learn language in a vacuum. You're learning it. It's a tool for communicating with somebody else that's adaptive for you, that's going to help you to do well in life, help you to thrive, help you to bond with the mother. Now, it would appear that people with autism are disadvantaged in that respect, are often delayed in language development, sometimes don't develop language until they're well into childhood, actually. And even when they do develop language, the language is not optimally adapted for communication.
Mm-hmm.
So they might have a very good vocabulary, and they might even understand some good technical words, but it doesn't necessarily follow that they can connect with people through language. Because being able to connect with somebody, you need to be quite astute in figuring out what your listener's informational needs are. And you need to say just the right amount, not too much and not too little.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas people with autism are very poor at doing that. And in consequence, they tend to be isolated from the social environment. Now, they've still got a big brain, they've still got a powerful intellect, but they're not using it, for whatever reason, not using it to engage with the social world. And perhaps that presents them with an opportunity to engage with the physical world and develop a sharper, a, you know, better understanding of the physical world.
Hence the reason why we really should be celebrating, you know, rather than looking at the positive side of autism, rather than, as you said, focusing too much on the social aspects of the developmental condition.
Absolutely right, because in the olden days, especially in the USA, there was a tendency to think that the way to help people with autism was to train them using so-called behavior techniques, to train them in the way that you might train an animal to do things. Mm-hmm. They did it for, you know, the best of intent, I'm sure of that. I'm sure they were quite sincere about what they were doing. But nevertheless, I think they were mistaken in this enterprise. So, you know, they'd teach kids just to behave as if they didn't have autism. Now, I think a better approach, actually, is to acknowledge and understand that these kids might be different and be tolerant and give these kids the space to develop. They're not going to develop like typical kids, but there's every chance that they can develop their skills, pursue their basic talents and develop their skills to a very high level. Mm-hmm. I mean, I don't think they're ever going to be the world's best socializer. It's never going to happen. Yeah. But they might be able to excel in the things that interest them. And, you know, some people have speculated that people like Isaac Newton and Einstein and various people like this perhaps had autism.
Right. Do you think all of us are on the spectrum at some stage?
Autism is regarded as a spectrum that shades into normality. That's the view that clinicians have. And so you can see aspects of, you can see autistic characteristics in many people, but you'd have to be at an extreme end to warrant a diagnosis or a label of autism.
We'll come back and find out more about the diagnostic process, as well as, you know, how do we not be overly optimistic about the condition as well. That's coming up next on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9.
This is a download from BFM 89.9. The Business Station.
Good afternoon. Welcome. It is The Bigger Picture and it's Meera Sivisuthi. Dr. Peter Mitchell, editor of the British Journal of Psychology, professor and director of studies in psychology at University of Nottingham, Malaysia campus. We're just discussing heightened abilities and special interests in people with autism. Of course, Peter, you've been doing research over time on this area of autism. But as we left off just now, how do you diagnose someone with autism?
There are various ways to do it, but one of the most valued or respected ways of doing it would be with the Autism Diagnostic Observation Schedule, or with the Autism Diagnostic Interview. The Autism Diagnostic Interview, shortened to the ADI, is actually an interview with the parents, but it's a very, very detailed and stretched interview that can, you know, last for a couple of hours maybe. Mm-hmm. The Autism Diagnostic Observation Schedule is something that you actually do with the child themselves, and it's basically a structured play session, and you ask the child to engage with various toys, you ask them very specific questions, you make close observations according to objective criteria, and you follow the manual, follow the checklist, follow the training you've had, to see if a diagnosis is warranted, basically. Now, these systems are all based on the so-called DSM, the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders, published by the American Psychological Association. And there, you know, this is a manual of the criteria or the characteristics of disorders. And then using those criteria, specialists have developed certain tests. And the world's most respected tests are probably the ones I said, the ADI and the ADOS.
Okay. And it's accurate? Is there a chance of misdiagnosis?
Absolutely. Of course there is, yeah.
I mean, what are the chances?
I'm not sure what the chances are, but, you know, with any test, there's always a chance of diagnosis. But let me give you an example. In doing research that you hope is going to be published in a first-class international journal, the editorial team will require that you re-diagnose the participants in this research. So they might, if this was the UK, they'd come to us already with a diagnosis, probably done with the ADOS. But we would have to re-diagnose as a way of confirming that the diagnosis is correct. Mm-hmm. Now, it doesn't necessarily mean that the diagnosis we do is better than the diagnosis that the clinician did, but if we both came to the same conclusion mm-hmm. using the objective criteria, I think we can be reasonably confident that here we have a case of autism. But I can tell you that there are some cases when we re-diagnose and they don't look autistic, mm-hmm. actually. And it's not particularly common. In my experience, it happens occasionally.
Is it something that improves with time as children grow?
Absolutely, mm-hmm. yeah. But I'm not sure you go as far as to say that somebody who has autism is cured of autism. I don't think you could say that. But like I was saying before, it's a developmental disorder, and it changes with development. Mm-hmm. It impacts on development, but development changes the individual as well.
Right. As you said earlier, people often take it as read that people with autism lack a theory of mind,
yeah.
and the ability to consider the mental states of others.
Yeah.
But it's recognized as one of the key deficits of the autistic brain, as yeah. you mentioned. But apparently, the more you work with these individuals with autism, the more you realize that they don't lack it. Have you had that experience before?
Yes. This all gets us into the territory of how you carry out these tests, actually. And what kind of people that you're testing. So a simple test of theory of mind is something that it's asking the child to make a judgment about what somebody else believes, where that other person's belief who you're judging holds a different belief from you.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I'm not talking about a religious belief or something sophisticated. Yeah. I'm talking about a simple factual belief. And it would seem that young children, normally developing children below about 4 or 5 years, are not really very effective in judging that somebody else could think something different from them.
Mm-hmm.
And the same seems to be true of people with autism, but to a later age, maybe to the age of 11. Now, when this discovery was first made about 3 decades ago, people thought that the hallmark of having autism is that you cannot grasp that somebody has a belief that's different from your own. But it turns out not to be true. Because if you're testing somebody who's very high-functioning, who has high IQ, who grows up to be an adult, they can easily pass these tests. But that doesn't mean to say that their ability to understand other people has gone away or is cured. It just means that they're clever at figuring out how to give the right answer to tests that you present to them.
Right.
But perhaps I can tell you about a piece of research that I've been involved in recently.
Mm-hmm.
It's related to understanding other people's reactions. Now, my PhD student, Dania Pillay, who's just finishing her PhD this year, she's somebody who did her Master's in Clinical Psychology at UKM and then came to Nottingham to do a PhD, and she's just finishing now. And she's done a brilliant job, and she's published articles in the world's very best journals on this subject. The centrepiece of her research involves showing participants somebody's reaction to something that happened to them, and the participant's task is to guess what it was that happened.
Mm-hmm.
Now, typically, and this is for adults, not just for kids, this is adults. Now, it turns out that humans, ordinary adults, are terrifically good at guessing, just seeing somebody's spontaneous reaction. It's not following a script, it's not enacted, it's just that something happens to them, and you see the reaction in their face, and people are terrifically good at guessing what happened to them.
Mm-hmm.
And it's almost as if they can read the mind, but what they're doing is they're just looking at the behaviour, and they can tell from those clues.
Yeah.
People with autism, however intelligent, however high the IQ, and however mature, they're just not so good at picking up those cues. Now, I think there's an important implication here for typically developing people who can interpret somebody else's response. They're not just being able to make an inference about what's going on in that person's mind. They're not just doing that. They, through the lens of another person's mind, are having some kind of vision onto a broader reality, because something in the world happens to that person, and by seeing their reaction, you can guess what it was. So therefore, you have access to something in the world just by looking at somebody else's reaction. And I think that's a very important and powerful aspect of the human intellect, that you can read somebody else, not just to find out what's in their mind, but to find out what's in the broader world. And it's something that people with autism, however smart they are, probably not so good at doing.
Mm-hmm. But, you know, early diagnosis is very, very important. And the reasons for that, Professor?
The reason for early diagnosis being important is because if you did not have an early diagnosis, then it's extremely likely that you'd explain the child's behaviour problems as bad parenting, as naughtiness. You'd be punishing the child all the time, maybe. You'd be trying to discipline them. The parents would be blamed all the time. The parents would think that, you know, the child's possessed by some spirit or something. But, you know, what's actually happened in this case is the child has a condition, and that condition is autism. And the reason why they have a condition is not their fault. It's because they've inherited a certain set of genes. You know, this is a genetic-based disorder.
Has that been confirmed?
Absolutely. So,
is it all genetics?
It's not all genetics. What we find, and when I say we, I mean the, you know, the research community, not me personally, but what's found is that, so take the case of identical twins. Here you have two individuals who have 100% in common genetically. If one of those twins has autism, is diagnosed with autism, there is an exceptionally high probability that the other twin would be diagnosed with autism as well. Mm-hmm. Now, if the other twin is not diagnosed with autism, it's almost certain that they'll be diagnosed with a developmental disorder that's similar to autism, like attention deficit disorder. There'll be something, you know, pragmatic language disorder. Now, if we take a look at an individual who has autism, who has a reliable diagnosis of autism, we can predict the probability that a relation of theirs will also have autism, depending on how genetically related they are. So the evidence is absolutely clear and compelling. Now, I guess when you said, do we know the genetic evidence, you might think that the answer is, oh, well, we've looked at genes so-and-so and so, and we've looked at the DNA. I mean, we don't know the answer to that, actually. Some people say they know some of the answer to it, but basically we don't know the full answer in terms of the DNA, in terms of the DNA, in terms of the microbiology, in terms of the genetics of it. We don't know the answer, but if we look at relatedness of individuals where we know how genetically related they are, it's absolutely clear that we're talking about genetic disorder.
Any other reasons for autism?
What I would say is that autism is something that you might have because you're genetically vulnerable to have autism. But I don't think it's 100% guaranteed that you'd have autism if you have that genetic vulnerability. Mm-hmm. Just as, you know, you might have genetic vulnerability for certain kinds of cancer, but it's not absolutely guaranteed that that would happen.
Yeah.
So there might be certain kinds of experiences that you can have that even though you're vulnerable, you don't actually develop the disorder. Now, if you were to ask me what kind of experiences they would be, in terms of scientific research, I don't know the answer, but I can give you my speculative opinions. My opinions would be that it's a good idea to treat these kids as individuals and respect them and be patient with them.
Mm-hmm.
And not try to force them into something that they're not. Allow their development to take place. I think that gives them every chance of the best possible outcome.
If you say it's genetic indeed, then is there a reason why? Is it because of awareness that we see more numbers in as far as children with autism are concerned?
Yeah.
As you said, the numbers were, you know, dismal back in the day. It's about 1 in 100, you know, now. Is it because of the lack of diagnosis, or, you know, what is it? Because if it was genes, it would have existed even before.
Yes. I think there's every reason to suppose that it's all about the diagnosis. And in the early days, the diagnosis would be done in a different way. That would mean that only people with severe cases might be identified. And also, especially in the, you know, thinking about the UK, for example, there was a general lack of awareness. So teachers, you know, how do you get to a situation where a child goes to a clinician and gets diagnosed? Well, it might be the parent thinks there's something strange, the teacher thinks something is strange, or the GP. But in the days before there was such awareness, then it wouldn't occur to the parents. They'd just think, oh, well, the child needs to be disciplined more, or the teachers, they wouldn't realise it. So that growing awareness leads to more referrals. And meanwhile, the system of diagnosis casts a broader net, so to speak, because in the early days, people would be diagnosed, for example, if they hadn't learned to speak by the age of 5 or 7 years, or so, you know, be very severe. Whereas now people might get a diagnosis even if they are less severe, even if they've acquired a vocabulary, but there are still the classic signs of autism.
So what you're saying is we shouldn't just focus on behavioral therapy, which is the biggest weakness of the autistic child, but to look at other areas as well that we can celebrate.
I think so, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Your message, Peter, on children with heightened abilities and special interests, especially those with autism. How do we be optimistic, but at the same time not be overly optimistic?
Yeah. Well, all I can say is that in my life as a university lecturer, I've seen many students, undergraduate students, who I've subsequently discovered had a diagnosis of autism, who do quite well at university level. We have one such boy in our class at Nottingham University here on this campus, and he's doing very well. I've seen PhD students. I've even seen members of academic staff, faculty, who have a formal diagnosis of autism, and they're doing okay, actually. But as I said, we just need to be patient and supportive of these individuals and respectful of them. And you know, as far as they themselves are concerned, especially when they're becoming more mature, in most cases they're trying very, very hard to do well in the world. You know, they themselves are—they're the ones that want to do well and trying hard to do well. And I think they just need a bit of support and recognition from their carers, from the teachers, or from their parents. And the great majority of parents I've met—they have those qualities. They're being patient. They're being supportive. They're doing all they possibly can to help these kids. And they're doing the right thing.
Thank you very much for joining me.
It's a pleasure.
Dr. Peter Mitchell, editor of the British Journal of Psychology, as well as professor and director of studies in psychology, University of Nottingham, Malaysia campus. On The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, The Business Station.